Hey there, and welcome to the Oscars Death Race podcast, where we try to watch all the Oscar-nominated movies or die trying. My name is Paulo, and I'm your host. Hope everyone's doing well out there. As of releasing this episode, we are about half a week actually away from the Oscars. Meant to record this a little bit earlier this week, but got distracted by work. Anyway, we're down to the final stretch, so if you've been putting off any films to watch, now is your time to get them. I know if you have if you were unfortunate enough to miss Godzilla Minus One or Boy and the Heron in theaters, you may be out of luck. Apologies for that. Still, best of luck to everyone trying to get it done. Robot Dreams, if you are listening to this, might be a little late, but as of the day this episode comes out, there was a theatrical release. If you wanted to see it in theaters, hopefully you caught that. If that was the last one you're looking for, honestly, I couldn't think of a better film to end the Death Race on. Anyway, this week, despite coming out late, I'm going to put out two episodes this week. This episode you're listening to now is going to be my update episode, you know, what I've been watching. I was out of town for work, but still managed to get some films on the plane and plane ride back. And then, you know, later this week, I'm going to have John from Red Carpet Rosters on to look at who we and the betting markets think are the most likely films to win each category, as well as who we want to win. On that point, I'm actually bringing back my Oscars winners prediction contest. Rules are pretty simple. 1 point per category, plus an extra point for best picture, plus a point for correctly predicting how many films wins the most winning film is going to get. Ties are broken by getting the best picture winner correct, though I think everyone's going to pick the same one, and then afterwards by timestamp based on your submission. Last year, the top winner, Alicia, who was on the podcast this season, got 21 points correctly, meaning she missed only four categories. In addition, we had four people beat Gold Derby's 19 and six tying the Gold Derby picks. In addition, we as a community on average tied Gold Derby with 19 correct predictions out of 23. Last year we had 72 entrants, looking to getting more this year. Also, hopefully growing this year, the number of people who have completed the Death Race. Last episode, we were at 55 on OscarsDeathRace.com, 42 on DeathRaceTracking.com. Now we are up to 104 on the Oscars Death Race and 58 on Death Race Tracking. As always, here are the names of people who have completed the list from OscarsDeathRace.com. Congratulations to Alfredo 2, B Taco, Lorian Mirren, Life After Leslie, True Kieran, Mad IB, My Booster Seat, JCB.com, Peace and Associates, Duo, Spud Crowley, Danny Bobani, Holly Audrey Ann, Mary J, Under Lock and Key, Rick Squared, Scar Sap, McGeggle, N Zoller, White Fang, Diane Bishop, Fair Lady Astley, Lily Oscars, Rosali, Two-Putt Bogey, Colo Cotronis, M. Pinson, G-Space 1216, NKOAS, Aaron Inderi, Legendaire, Alan Gibson 71, Lobby Loiterer, C. Selkses, Ponio 90, Priyanka 42, CB 56, Plexaw, Iowa City Kyle, Zaz, Elliot F., Painter Dan, Algiv 03, Nicole Face, Kate Black, Matman 13, Coney Rick, and Cerulean Ruin. Congratulations to everyone. Myself, I'm up to 48 out of 53 total. That is 33 out of 38 features and all 15 sorts. This translates to about 21 out of 23 completed categories and 115 out of 120 nominations accounted for. I watched Io Capitano back on the 24th before I went for my work trip. And then on the plane back, I watched Society of Snow, which is interesting to watch on the plane, as well as El Conde on the 29th. And then, you know, last weekend on the evening of the 2nd and 3rd, I powered through the remaining five sorts in the documentary category. That leaves me with three from the featured documentaries and then the two song only nominees. Ranking wise, last time I checked, I was at 130 out of 620 on Death Race Tracking and 261 out of 1179 on OscarsDeathRace.com. Last year, I was at 214th on OscarsDeathRace.com out of 1103. My best ever was 103 out of 1158 in 2021. So hoping to get in the similar-ish range this year. Now, before we get to my reviews of these films that I watched, there's some industry and guild awards to go over. This is from before my work trip, some of this might be old news, but this definitely does, I think, help figure out who's going to be winning at certain points. So, SAG Awards. On the 24th, the Cast Award went to Oppenheimer. Actress, in a pretty big deal, went to Lily Gladstone, keeping that particular race tight. Supporting actress, Divine Joy Randolph, as you expected. Cillian Murphy won for actor, kind of killing the hopes for Paul Giamatti. And then Robert Downey Jr. took supporting actor. At the Producers Guild Award on the 25th, the theatrical, you know, Producers Guild Award went to, of course, Oppenheimer. Spider-Verse won for animated feature, and then American Symphony won for documentary, though that's obviously not nominated for the Oscars. For the Indie Awards, also on the 25th, we'll go through, you know, all these categories. Past Lives, you know, won for Best Feature. This won over American Fiction. Celine Song also won Best Director, though there wasn't any competition there from Oscar contenders. Lead Performance went to Jeffrey Wright. Again, no Oscar competitors in the category. Divine Joy Randolph won for Supporting Performance over Sterling K. Brown. You know, these are gender neutral categories. Screenplay went to American Fiction, which notably won over Holdovers and Past Lives, which I think hints at how American Fiction might be a bit of a stronger contender this for the adapted category. Breakthrough Success went to Dominic Sessa from The Holdovers. First Feature went to 1001. First Screenplay went to Sammy Birch for May December. Documentary Feature went to Four Daughters, which has no Oscar competition in this category. And then notably, Anatomy of a Fall won International Feature over Zone of Interest. The Cinema Audio Society Awards on the 2nd went to Oppenheimer for live action, and Spider-Verse for animated, and then 32 Sounds for documentary. The USC Scripters Awards for, you know, adapted screenplays went on the 2nd, went to American Fiction, again, making it a little bit of a stronger contender for the category. The American Society of Cinematographers went on the 3rd, went to Oppenheimer. For the MPSC, you know, the Sound Editors Award, on the 3rd, Oppenheimer got two awards, one for Foley, one for ADR. Spider-Verse got it for animated, and then Society of Snow got it for foreign, while Maestro also picked up a win for music. This kind of suggests that, you know, Oppenheimer will probably be the winner for sound here. For the ACE Awards, the American the Editing Awards, on the 3rd, Oppenheimer won for drama, Holdovers won for comedy, Spider-Verse won for animated, and then Still the Michael J. Fox documentary won, of course, for documentary. And then the Guild Music Supervisors Award on the 3rd, Barbie actually, so they break this out by budget. Barbie actually won for film music supervision for a film over $25 million. Sub $25 million went to Joyride, sub $10 million went to Theater Camp, and then the song most notably went to What Was I Made For? And then Satellite Awards, final major award of the year, unless, of course, you count the Deathy Awards, which I will be presenting as part of the day before the Oscars on the 9th. But in any case, the Satellite Awards on the 3rd, bunch of categories here. Oppenheimer won for drama, Holdovers won for comedy, Boy and the Heron, you know, keeping it close for the race, went to animated feature. Chris Nolan won for director, Cillian Murphy won for best actor in a drama, while Giamatti, best actor in a comedy. Lily Gladstone won for actress, Emma Stone won for actress in comedy, so no real indicator there. Mark Ruffalo apparently won for supporting actor, which is a bit surprising over Robert Downey Jr. And then Divine Joy Randolph, of course, for supporting actress. American Fiction, again, adapted screenplay nominee, pretty good. Maestro, of all things, won the original screenplay, which is a little bit of a weird one. Zone of Interest won international. Maestro won cinematography, also a bit of a weird choice, though Matthew Libatique definitely can sue the good-looking film. Holdovers also weirdly won for editing. Again, this is kind of going against a lot of the convention. I wouldn't read too much into this. Napoleon won for costume, Barbie for production, American Fiction for score, What Was I Made for song, Maestro for sound, and Mission Impossible for the visual effects. So yeah, we'll go over, of course, you know, next episode, all of the precursors from this past season and figure out what they mean for who is likeliest to win. But for now, let's turn to the films I actually was able to watch for this episode. So first off, we'll go to a film I was supposed to watch a couple weeks ago, but ended up not getting to round two. But this is El Conde. So El Conde is a Chilean black comedy horror film, directed by Pablo Larraín, who's probably most recently known for directing Spencer, the film about, you know, Princess Diana, starring Kristen Stewart. You know, it was at the Venice Film Festival, and then it won the Screenplay Award, released on Netflix September of last year. You know, notably 4 days after the coup d'état of Pinochet in Chile, and then Augusto Pinochet, who's, you know, kind of like in the film, he's basically portrayed as being a vampire, and of course this was nominated for Best Cinematography, so not in the international category. Now, I'll admit this was a very good looking film. This kind of feels a lot like Bardo to some degree, where, you know, if it's a little bit hard to follow with this on the read, though not as hard as Bardo. You know, the allegory here of, you know, kind of mocking these dictators who basically, you know, suck the lifeblood out of the you know, the working class folk, was you know, an apt metaphor, right? You know, and then how the families were trying, you know, I think as a story wise, it was serviceable enough, right? I don't think it was the greatest thing ever, right? But you know, I think obviously the cinematography here, by noted cinematographer Edward Lachman, you know, which to his credit, you know, he for example saw the Carol with Todd Haynes. You know, he's a fairly well known cinematographer. He, you know, the way that he has makes it the black and white, the shot in black and white looks really, really beautiful. Not beautiful, interesting, I'll say. And then, you know, specifically like the flying sequences with the vampires also looked really good as well. I will say, you know, one particular actress who stood out to me was Paula Luchinger, who is apparently a who plays like the nun within the film. Just like the way she looks at the camera and like just kind of stares with her unblinking eyes, definitely unsettling. Also, a bit of a spoiler, but did not expect to see Margaret Thatcher coming in to this film. Kind of is almost like when you were watching Golda, and then you have surprise Henry Kissinger in here, which I guess, you know, depending on how you feel about Margaret Thatcher, which is probably the same as way you feel about Henry Kissinger for most people. Probably kind of shows you like if they're whoever they're allied with, maybe not the person you want to be considered the good guy in the film, so to speak. So yeah, I mean, you know, I think this definitely earned its cinematography nomination. Not necessarily upset, I guess, you know, without having seen it, I was a little upset that, you know, say you know, Asteroid City or even Saltburn didn't get the nomination, but you know, this is a worthy nominee for that particular category as well. Overall, the film probably like a 3 out of 5, if I'm frank. But yeah, now in the cinematography category, as far as who I think will win, probably gonna be Oppenheimer. I mean, he won the ASC of Hoyte van Hoytema. You know, it looked the. I mean, Oppenheimer just, yeah, it's sweeping, I think, this year. So, and honestly, I'm not too upset about that, though. If I had my pick, I would probably go with Poor Things. Just with the way that they play with the camera, lenses and frames and aperture rates, you know, I think that's really cool for me. All right, moving then to another international film. This one is actually nominated for international category, as well as another category. This is Society of Snow. So this one follows the story of the 1973 plane crash in the Andes Mountains that carried a group of rugby players on Uruguayan Air Force Flight 571. It's directed by J.A. Bayona, based on a 2009 book of the same name by Pablo Vierci, who is a friend of some of the survivors. It premiered at the Venice Film Festival, and then you released in the U.S. on the 22nd before coming to Netflix on January 4th, where apparently it really performed really, really well. You know, it got two awards. It won 12 awards at the Goya Awards, the Spanish Oscars equivalency, including Best Picture and Best Director. And as I mentioned, nominated for Best International Feature for Spain, and then also Best Hair and Makeup. So I mean, this is a story that has been told before. I personally have never seen any adaptations of the film of this story before, but there have been other adaptations of the story. And you know, I think what this film does, you know, I think it's not a perfect film by any means, right? I think it's a couple of pacing issues here. I think the biggest for me, right, and maybe this is my fault, but you know, they made it not being familiar with any of the actors and not really having a key latching on point to, it was really hard for me to follow who was who at any particular point in time. So it was hard for me to like really get invested in these particular individuals and feel as bad as I maybe should have. When, you know, obviously over the course of time, not everyone survived. Some of them passed away, right? Over time, there were some people who I was able to recognize by name, by face, after I got used to them. But up until that point, it was like, you know, maybe not as good at being able to follow along that who was dying and where. I was watching this, frankly speaking, you know, with my phone open, just so I could keep track of, you know, I could like kind of read up on the events as they were happening in the film, because it's a really amazing story, right? It's kind of a crazy story of survival. Reminds me of, you know, when I was younger, one of my favorite books growing up was the book Hatchet, about a boy who crashes in a lake in Canada with only a hatchet and has to survive. But in any case, you know, as far as hair and makeup, I mean, honestly, I almost want this one to be my who I want to win for the category. I mean, what they do to make these boys go from, you know, the young college kids that you see at the beginning of the film to the haggard, you know, worn down by the weathered look on them, you know, the gaunt face on them, and as it progresses throughout the film, as it gets worse and the condition gets worse and worse, that is just something stupendous, actually, honestly. I would love to see more about this, to see this win. And it's probably not going to. You know, I think Maestro is the favorite to win this category, but you know, definitely enjoyed that one. So yeah, like I mentioned, that overall, I would give this one, you know, again, probably like a 3 out of 5. It was a decent enough watch. Definitely not one that I enjoyed watching. Like I said, I watched this on the plane back from my work trip, so I didn't realize until after this sport, I'm like, oh, that was an odd choice for me to watch on the film, on the plane. But yeah, no, definitely worth a watch, especially if you're interested in this particular story. Pretty gruesome, especially during the plane crash sequence. That was much more graphic than I expected it to be, frankly speaking. But yeah, overall, enjoyed the film. Which then brings us to the international category. So I already talked about Society of Snow just now, and I've also already talked about Zone of Interest. So let's talk about the other films, and you know, let's do these in alphabetical order. So you know, most recently I watched Io Capitano. That is a Italian film about African teenagers who make their way from to make their way from Senegal all the way up to Italy, right? Which involves, you know, getting fake passports, you know, crossing the Sahara Desert, you know, getting captured by slave traders, having to, you know, essentially escape and get their freedom, and then, you know, illegally crossing the Mediterranean Sea by boat in order to get to Sicily, right? It competed for the Golden Lion at the film festival, where it did win the Silver Lion for Best Directing, and also an award for Seyou Sarr, the main actor, for his performance as well, which, you know, apparently he's a first-time actor, which I would not have known. You know, and obviously this is, I think, a bit of I don't know if it's a commentary, but it's a Homeric epic, so to speak, on the ongoing migrant crisis, right? You know, maybe putting a name to a face of these migrants who, and just kind of like what they risk to get to Europe, right? I think one critique I have of this film is that, you know, the question is, right, like at the beginning, it's like, why do you want to leave, right? Obviously, you know, it's so that, you know, they don't have a lot, right? But they are happy with what they have. But, you know, the boys kind of like they want more. They have dreams of becoming superstars, and they come and then they go all through all these hardships, and then, you know, not spoiler, but they get to the end, they do get to Italy. And I just, you know, it feels left off, because honestly, knowing kind of like the way that migrants are being treated in Europe at the moment, they're not in for an easy life. They're not going to reach their dream, even though the end of the film makes it seem like it is. And that is just that's just really unfortunate. I feel like it makes the ending feel hollow for me, knowing just the situation that they're going to have to face, the continued difficulties they're going to have to face after this triumphant journey, right? So-called triumphant journey. The other thing, right, that was interesting, there were a couple of sequences in here that seem a little bit more on like the magical realism side of things. You know, they're in the end actually dream sequences, but it kind of like, and I honestly thought that those were interesting. I would have either loved to see them removed entirely, right, and then focus on the more realistic nature of their journey and their travel, or lean into that more and have that be more present throughout the film, the dreams that they have of throughout the journey. I thought, you know, beyond the two sequences, I think it was either underused or you know, it was either underused and should have been used more, or it was distracting and shouldn't have been included at all. Yeah, I mean, yeah, this was an interesting film to watch. I think it's fair enough. I'll give this one a 3 out of 5 overall. Are there other films that probably could have and should have gotten in? I don't know. I haven't seen all the potential shortlisted nominees. I mean, I watched the Philippine ones, but I'm obviously biased toward that. I know Fallen Leaves was one of the people were thinking would get in, but ended up not getting in, which, you know, I can understand. Personally, I could see why people liked it. That wasn't necessarily my cup of tea. So, you know, this was a satisfactory one. I don't think it was undeserving of a nomination. I don't know if there was another one who was necessarily robbed of a nomination. Unless, of course, you know, I feel like maybe if Anatomy of Fall had been submitted by France, this probably would have been the one to be excluded from the overall from this five, I think. Next up, we have Perfect Days. So this one, I believe, is coming out to streaming soon, maybe tomorrow as of recording this. But I actually saw this in the Angelica Film Theater here in New York. There was a one-week qualifying run in December, so that's when I watched it. Though I could have watched it, I guess, later on when it came back to theaters. You know, this one follows. So this one debuted at the Cannes Film Festival. It's actually by German director Wim Wenders. Or Wim Wenders, I guess, which is interesting because, you know, obviously there was also Miyazaki's film, Boy and the Heron, which was nominated. There was also, the film Monster by Ryusuke Hamaguchi, which also was a very well-deserving film. Interesting that they went with a non-Japanese director here. You know, it follows, you know, four short stories of this toilet cleaner in Japan, played by Koji Yakusho, who actually won the Best Actor Award at the Cannes Film Festival. It follows this story, and I wrote a review for this on Dakota's site for ConvaZoom Pod. It follows, you know, this guy who has this routine, this life. He's very quiet, kind of a bit of a recluse, but he takes pride in his work, which is, you know, cleaning, you know, frankly, the most beautiful looking toilets on the planet. You know, he has his free time. He listens to music. He reads books on the weekend. He has this routine. He has this restaurant he goes to every day. He dreams at night. You kind of see that he grows his plants in his apartment, and then, you know, over time, it, you know, you have some interruptions to his life, right? He has a young assistant who is, you know, a bit of a mess, and his girlfriend, you know, he has an interaction kind of by remote learning with a stranger in the toilet, where he leaves a piece of paper with tic-tac-toe. Meets up with his niece ends up coming to stay with him after running away from home for some unknown reason, and then you know, there's also a whole situation with him and then this bar the proprietor of a bar, you know, potential romance, potential just friendship, but there's a weird situation going on there. And you know, it's very meditative, very contemplative, and frankly not a lot happens. It's very slice of life, but this is something I found really special. I've been, you know, people have been saying this is the last film that they have coming up on, like one of the last films they have to watch for the death race. I always recommend make this the last film you watch, because it's a meditation on life that just makes you think about like what's important in your life. It doesn't necessarily say, oh, people who are blue collar workers are better per se, but also there is a bit of like loneliness that seems to come into his life, but he seems to have accepted that, right? And so I think, for me personally, what I took away was, you know, appreciating the little things in your life, appreciating these small moments, even in the hustle and bustle of a major city, which, you know, living in New York, I can definitely relate to. But even in the hustle and bustle of a city, you can find these moments of quiet and solitude and appreciate those, right? You don't need a complicated life. You don't need a busy life to be happy. You can, right? But as long as you can find the moments of peace and quiet and pride in your own work, I think that is the, I think that's what this film is trying to convey about that. So, yeah, I mean, this is honestly one of my top three films of this year's Death Race. I would give this one a 5 out of 5, frankly speaking. So definitely my favorite. And finally, you know, we have a Teacher's Lounge. This one I watched, I believe, the week of the nominations. I went to the Angelica Film Center to watch this one. It's a German submission. It follows a young teacher at a school in Germany. And then, you know, there's... You know, it's interesting, actually, now that I think about it, there's some connection between these and other films, right? So this one kind of ties to, you know, there's a bit of like, you know, maybe racism or whatever, where, you know, a young student of color is accused, you know, there's been a string of of thefts happening at the school. This young idealistic, you know, teacher, her name's Carla, is tries to stand up for the kids, but then there are also, thefts happening among the teachers, and she leaves her laptop webcam running when she goes to school, when she goes to class. And then it records somebody who is who's taking something from her jacket. You can't really see who, but you can kind of see the sleeve of the person's shirt. And that leads to a whole series of accusations about, is this the person who did it? Is it not? And it points at, maybe there's some hypocrisy, right? Of the way that that people want things to be resolved. When your ideals are challenged, what is the most pragmatic thing, and then what is also the most idealistic thing? In a lot of ways, it reminds me of the other Japanese film I mentioned, Monster, which kind of deals with, an idealistic teacher, and then kind of like how the school has to respond to accusations of impropriety by a certain teacher, right? Very stressful. So Teacher's Lunch is a very stressful watch. I'm honestly not entirely sure what to make of the ending, what it's trying to say at the end. And I appreciate that, right? It's definitely one to mull over and think. I don't think even in the month or so since I've watched it, I've come to a satisfying conclusion on what the ending is supposed to mean and kind of like where I would want the story to end up. But this was definitely a thinker, very well made. I think like there's definitely some shots of cinematography following the teacher as he walks through the school to try to get stuff done. The child actors in here are pretty good, especially it's not just one or two, but it's your whole classes of kids acting that are very well done. So yeah, I mean, this is definitely one I think that's a little bit better than some of the others. I would put this one at the 4 out of 5. Definitely worth seeking out, even outside of the death race, right? I mean, I would say the others are films that I wouldn't go out of my way to watch if not for the death race. This is one, even outside of the death race, I would probably recommend to somebody to check out if you're into film. So yeah, I mean, who will win the international category? It's pretty obvious. I think it's going to be Zone of Interest. I don't think there's ever been a case of someone nominated in both international and Best Picture that ended up not getting nominated, not winning. But frankly, for me, it should be Wim Wenders' A Perfect Days. And, that quite contemplative film, with a little bit of a positive, upbeat ending, a life-affirming ending, is definitely one that I wish I could see being rewarded. All right, rounding out this week's episode, then we have the 5 documentary shorts. Again, I powered through these all. Luckily, these are all available online, so I didn't have to go watch them at the IFC Center. 3 of these, I believe, were on. 3 of these were on YouTube. 2 of them were on. 2 of them were on streaming services, I believe, Paramount Plus and Disney Plus. So these are all accessible. So just in the order that I watched them, I mostly watched them from longest to shortest. First up is Last Repair Shop. So this one is by Chris Bowers. He did the music for, I believe, The Color Purple. He also was nominated for another documentary concert in a Concerto is a Conversation. And, this one follows essentially like the LA school district provides free instruments to kids for them to play, right? If you want to learn how to play the clarinet, the tuba, the violin, whatever, apparently the school district will provide, which is, a great thing, support the arts and all that. And obviously, right, kids being kids, there'll be repairs that need to be made to these instruments. So it follows the four of the people who work at the repair shop for all of these instruments. And it's divided into 4 sections, right? 4 different parts of the orchestra, right? You have piano, you have brass, you have woodwind, you have strings, violin. And it follows the story of 4 different people who work at one for each section, right? So, like other Chris Bowers documentaries, this one face on, straight to the camera. It's kind of like talking about yourself, talking about your story. And granted, there is a little bit more inner cut throughout about, their personal history, right? Like one person is LGBT, their story, while they were was still about finding themselves, and coming out and coming out over life and how that kind of like translates to his work there. This one is an immigrant from Mexico and kind of how she ended up getting the job there and what it means for her. One was a young kid who ended up becoming a famous fiddle player, not famous but like a a traveling working musician for a while, and how music changed his life thanks to this, you know, violin that he picked up at a fair that someone, you know, loaned him the money for. And then the last one, right, was about an Armenian who, you know, escaped, you know, genocide, and came over to the United States, and, you know, he got his start in working in the States, you know, doing instrument repairs for his host family, with his host family, right? I mean, and there, and it all crescendos, pun intended, to this, you know, this orchestra, this unique, this orchestra of alumni from the school district, you know, some current students, some past students, playing these instruments to this unique score, this unique piece, basically, about and kind of showing the power of music. And, you know, I mean, there are definitely some themes here of, you know, like kind of the story of like, hey, these people helped me in my life. I'm going to help the next generation out by providing them music and helping them find inspiration and so on. All nice and good. I'm just really annoyed at documentaries that are basically talking head documentaries, right? Sure, there is stuff throughout to kind of flesh out these characters. I think one, they were trying to do a little bit too much. I think there was like too much in there, and too many stories. And you could say, obviously, there is, you know, it's the structure of the orchestra and it all comes together and yada, yada, yada. That's fine. I don't know. I feel it jumped around a lot. I would have loved to get a deeper dive into any one of these stories rather than kind of like the relatively surface level one. The other one was like, you get these interviews with kids about, oh yeah, I like the music, right? It doesn't really show the impact. It's definitely like a tell, not show type of story. And that's kind of like the most annoying thing about documentaries for me. Honestly, I was going to give this 2 out of 5 stars. I ended up, I think, bumping it to 3 out of 5 stars just because, you know, that last musical piece is really, really good. And I appreciate that. And kind of like I couldn't deny the emotion that was coming up watching that. But I mean, structurally, this is just like this is not the kind of documentary I really want to support. So, you know, I know it's a lot of people's favorites. I know it's probably the favorite to win, or at least one of the two most likely to win. But yeah, this is, I could definitely have gone, I could definitely think there were better documentaries that probably could have gotten in. Next up is Barber of Little Rock. This follows an individual in Little Rock, Arkansas, who, you know, essentially, it tells the story of redlining, of racial inequality in the States. You know, this does have some talking head elements to it, but it also shows this individual who's, you know, a barber in Little Rock, and kind of what he does, he starts essentially like this financial institution to help essentially the underbanked community, the Black community in Little Rock, to essentially start, you know, getting, you know, help formerly incarcerated people get loans, get grants to get their life back on track, right? Help people in emergency housing situations get loans. And you know, he helps train up a new generation of barbers so that they can be entrepreneurs on their own, right? And you know, there are some criticisms that maybe it's a little bit repetitive. You know, personally, I think it did. If you're not paying attention, it could seem that way. I think they did a good enough job of jumping between different, subtly different, but still distinct issues around the whole racial inequality system, and seeing that it, you know, seeing the work being done here through this is just like what I like about documentaries. It's a very, there's like a story of like this one person who is doing something. It teaches me something about the world. Seeing them in action, I think, is what's really powerful here, right? Seeing him giving these grants, like talking to these people, talking to this community, making a difference in these lives. That's what I think is really powerful. That's why, honestly, I like this one more. I probably give this one like 4 out of 5. Next up, I watched ABCs of Book Burning. This is the one on Paramount Plus. And, oh boy. So, first off, don't get it twisted. I am definitely against you know, banning books and so on. You know, that's definitely something I do not want to happen in this country. But the way this one was done was just even more amateurish than it had even fewer things that I liked than Last Repair. So at least that one had like a, you know, a bit of a structure to it, even if I disagreed with the creation. This one essentially follows, you know, the issue of book banning happening across the countries. Half of it feels like a slideshow of like, oh, here's a title of a book, maybe a quote from the book about like, you know, what might be quote unquote subversive about it, and then saying that, oh, it's banned or restricted or whatever, right? Specifically in Florida, which unfortunately they were actually in my hometown of Jacksonville talking about it. And then they gave these, you know, these kids, you know, some of these banned books, and the kids are, why are these being banned? This is so silly. I think it's not great for these to be banned, right? Which, again, firmly believe in. It just felt very unbelievable that it felt like the kids were way too prepared for these. Like, they were almost being coached almost. And maybe that's not, maybe this, that's just how the youth talk nowadays. I think, like, halfway through the film, I was honestly thinking, like, okay, how would I make this film better? I would say, you know, and obviously they're saying, oh, we want to put the voice of the kids who are affected. And so that's a great vision for it. At the same time, I also think it would have been a much more effective, almost satire, not even satire, just like a much more effective approach to essentially confront people who are trying to ban these books, and then essentially put, look, are you literally saying that, you know, stories of race and whatever are problematic, right? Or of LGBT, of queerness, right? Of whatever issue that they have with these books, these are issues that you should, that the reasons why these books should be banned. I mean, I think that would have been more effective to kind of present almost like a Jordan Kepler type way, like he does on The Daily Show, where he goes to Trump voters and kind of essentially uses their own words to kind of paint them as being kind of buffoons, basically. And that would have been a much more effective. This is very much blunt hammer trying to hammer a point home. I honestly think that the biggest reason that this one ended up getting nominated was because this was directed by Sheila Nevins, who is the head of MTV Documentary Films, and formerly president of HBO Documentary Films. She's had like 35 documentary Emmys, 42 Peabodys, 26 Academy Award nominations as a producer. The fact that she is, you know, directing this, I think is where all the connections come in. People are supporting, and obviously it's a topic that, you know, especially like the more liberal Hollywood is definitely going to get behind. So frankly speaking, this is probably going to be the winner. I don't like it. I'm not going to vote. I'm not going to say it's going to win officially, but it probably is going to be the one to win, frankly speaking. I give this one 1 out of 5 stars. Like, it's such a shame that you, like, a documentary about such an important topic gets fumbled in the delivery so poorly. All right. Moving then, we have Island in Between. Now, I know a lot of people didn't like this one or found it kind of lacking, right? So this is like a New York Times op-ed, and it essentially is about the island of Kinmen, which is essentially an island pretty much like 26 miles, 83 miles, something like that, away from the Chinese mainland. It's technically part of Taiwan, but it's actually closer to mainland China than it is to Taipei, like the island of Taiwan. And it talks about, you know, the filmmaker, right? His name's S. Leo Chang. He was born in Taiwan, you know, moved to the United States, and then came back to stay with his parents, you know, during COVID. And, like, it was just fascinating to see, like, there's this, like, this island that's, like, kind of, like, almost an artifact of this history, right? Obviously, the history of China and Taiwan is still very much ongoing. I mean, being Filipino, you hear about China, you know, encroaching on South China, on the Philippine Sea and all of, like, and everything going on there. It's very much still an active situation on one hand. But on the other hand, it's, like, there's no, like, they tell a story about how they opened up this ferry between Taiwan and China, and mainland China, that could pass between the two, right? Then that's just crazy, right? I think this is where, maybe this is one where I think this was, that's what the documentary really does well. Tells a very personal story. This guy has this connection, and how he feels kind of like this, you know, in the same way I could tell, right, he's Asian American, but also Taiwanese, kind of between the two. In the same way, Kinmen is in Taiwan and Taipei, almost are also pawns almost in the U.S. Chinese relations, right, in the area, in the APAC region, right? I could see how people could say, hey, this isn't a lot, but I really just appreciated it feels almost like, again, slice of life document, like what I really want from a documentary, like on the ground. Maybe there's not even necessarily a true story there. It's kind of like the context around it, what gives it its meaning, and kind of like seeing what life is like, right? It's sharing a part of the world that I would not see otherwise. This is something I had no idea about that I learned so much about, even just through this short, you know, 15, 17-minute documentary. Sir, could have done more. I would have loved to see more about, like, you know, what is life in Kinmen like more. But just giving us like a taste of that in this short film, I think did a very great job. So I gave this one a 4 out of 5, maybe by Asian American stuff, but definitely like this one a lot. And then finally, my favorite documentary sort, much hyped actually, Nine Night in Waipo. So this is by director Sean Wang, who just had his feature debut in Didi at Sundance. This one features his two grandmothers. So Nine Night in Waipo are Taiwanese terms for maternal and paternal grandmother. It looks like, you know, both of their spouses have passed, and now the two of them live together essentially in Sean Wang's home. And you know, this is a story of him, you know, just documenting what the life of his grandmothers are like, just living together, their friendship, right? One's about 10 years older than the other, you know, just what it means to be older and aging individual, right? Aging individual, aging Asian American person in this country, right? Kind of like what they do to stay fit, keep their mind active. It's kind of funny. They have like these dance sequences, these arm wrestling between the two of them. There's a lot of talk about farts in here. It's very cute, very charming, but there is also a bit of a depth to it, right? It's a bit of like advice from this older generation to him of what it means, and you know, kind of like treasure the moments with your age ones, because older ones, you don't know what it is, but they definitely still have some sass in there. Is it like the most groundbreaking documentary of all time? Of course not. Is it the most heartwarming documentary and the most personal of the documentaries of this five? Yes, I think that's definitely the case here. And you know, it's maybe it's not the most important topic in the world, but it's definitely the most, I think, human topic, right? And I think and subject matter. And I think that is, I think the one, maybe it's the most, maybe because I tend to like positive documentaries as opposed to like the more negative, like ones that bring up more negative feelings. This one's just all fluff in a good way, right? It's all good feelings, all good vibes. And, you know, again, good representation for Asian Americans. I gave this one 5 out of 5. I don't think it's going to win. I really think it should win. Actually, I will say there is a world where this could win. Maybe it's hard to say, right? You know, it's hard to really get a sense of that. There aren't really that many precursors, so it's kind of a wild shot. The fact that Sun Wang, you know, got a lot of love out of Sundance, right? And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, I don't know if one of his grandmas was an actress in the film. I know for sure. It definitely looks like they saw it in the same house. Because of the, you know, you could see like the same layout of the kitchen and everything. So who knows? Yeah, I mean, if I have to make one No Guts, No Glory prediction for this Oscars, it was going to be Nine Nine and Waipo, for all those reasons. Yeah, so yeah, that is all the films that I watched since the last episode. Again, I have 5 to go. 3 documentaries, 4 Daughters, Eternal Memory. What's the last one? Bobby Wine, the People's President, and then the 2 songs, American Symphony, and of course, ending with our good friend Diane Warren in Flame and Hot. So that's, you know, my one going to be watching over the next, I have 5 days until the Oscars, probably 4 by the time you're listening to this, so definitely need to get to it. And of course, also, you know, we have the Death Race Awards for the Academy of Death Racers coming this Saturday, so be sure to check that out. I believe it's 6 p.m. Eastern time. You know, your boy might be doing some presentations for a couple categories, a couple skits here and there. I have to film those and get those to Astro before the end of tomorrow. And then look for another episode. I think based on the timing of this, I'll probably put this one out on Saturday so you have a little bit of time to like listen to it and incorporate any feedback, any thoughts into, you know, who you think will win. Looking forward to that. Other than that, that wraps up this episode of the Oscars Death Race podcast. Good luck in these last few days. Let me know how your Death Race is going. Over on Twitter at OscarsDRacecast or email OscarsDeathRacePodcast@gmail.com. Make sure you subscribe to the show on your podcast of your choice, iTunes, Spotify, Google Play. If you can leave us a review or even share it with a friend who loves movies, any of that is super helpful. Those will all be linked in the show notes alongside my Letterboxd accounts under the username NinjaBoy, Boy with an I. Also, be sure to check out Oscar Race and Oscars Death Race subreddits and the Academy of Death Racers Discord, as well as AODR.net, OscarsDeathRace.com, and DeathRaceTracking.com. Music provided by Kevin MacLeod and Competent.Filmmusic.io. Editing production by NinjaBoy Media. That's it for this episode. See you later this week. This has been Paulo of the Oscars Death Race podcast. And until next time, I'll be here trying to watch all the Oscar nominees or die trying.